this is part of the post-truth agenda. So we're not only got bad, we have really no proper investigative journalism going on in the mainstream press. It's also the alternative press is being corralled and co-opted here by fake investigative journalists who are asking the wrong questions and also blaming victims, not the perpetrators. They're not trying to find, it seems, the actual perpetrators at all.
Right. I have investigative journalist Tony Gosling here. And before we start, I just want to say, myself and Tony, we were having a little chat earlier. It turns out we disagree on lots and lots of things, but we're not going to go there today because there's one thing we're kind of agreeing on. I think it's worth looking at and I think it's worth analysing, and that is the Manchester Arena bombing. Tony, I'm just going to give a little rundown of who you are. Tony is an investigative journalist, historian and broadcaster trained by the BBC. Now, that used to be a good thing. Now people will look at you with suspicion when you say trained by the BBC. Right. But I will say in its day, the BBC training used to be the gold standard. And we know now there's been so many lies from the BBC that people have changed their minds on that. But there was a time when journalism at least had some kind of ethical standards. So to be trained by the BBC isn't necessarily a bad thing. So it presents the Bristol Politics Show and has spent more than two decades reporting on geopolitics, intelligence, financial power structures and international affairs. So the show is recorded live every Friday from Bristol, and it looks back. It's kind of like an alternative view of the week in politics. I'm delighted to have you on, Tony, and delighted to get your take on this lad here. We have Richard D. Hall, and he says there was no bomb and nobody injured at the Manchester Arena. What do you say to this conclusion?
Well, I'll also add that the weekly programme we do looks at local politics here in Bristol too. So what we're doing is digging out stories of planning, development, land speculator, corruption, links to the Israeli atrocities from the tallest building that's being built here in Bristol city centre at the moment. So we're really interested in the sorts of stuff that the mainstream either don't know about or simply not covering. So it's largely a sort of private eye style program for anybody, whether it's a citizen or a freelance journalist in the city, who's digging out dirt on the corrupt system. And you know, you say at the start we disagree about quite a lot, but I can tell you I'm sure we agree about the corruption in the establishment. I think both in the media and other elite institutions like universities, obviously politics and political parties, there is a kind of prostitution going on, really. And I think you and I probably agree with that, that people are just not working for us. They're working for special interests. They're being bribed, possibly blackmailed too. But we're witnessing a really kind of dissolving, slow dissolving by organised crime of the democratic system. So that's the context that this all fits into. As for Richard Hall, I was just hearing the other day, actually, that when he was a younger man, this is like 20, 25 years ago, he was hiring a hall at the Salvation Army in Consett above the top floor. And the people in the town, which I know of you, were always wondering, how does he pay for this? He doesn't seem to actually be producing anything. So there is a sort of bit of a backstory to Hall. For me, the first time I saw any of his work was around the murder of Joe Cox, which seemed to be a kind of attempt to do a forensic look at everything. But my hackles went up. I'm thinking this is a little bit too polished. And what are we actually learning from this? The most important fact about the Joe Cox murder was that it happened just before the referendum. And horrendous as it was, it seemed to me to be some kind of instigation to get people behind the vote for Remain a week or so, or was it 10 days later, and to dominate the news agenda in the run-up to the actual vote in 2016. And so I wasn't really that interested in it. But then I started to realise that Hall was doing and had been involved in other, what I would call, psychological operations. Most importantly, you know, my view was on at 9/11, It was around about 2005, I believe, that maybe four or five, around that time, that it started to become conclusive, really, through architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth and people associated with that, including Danny Jawenko, who's a particularly articulate a building engineer, that the Building 7 and the Twin Towers had actually been brought down by controlled demolition. And this is, if you look at the 9/11 films, the fires are just about out at the top of the buildings on the Twin Towers. There's no fire of any kind of massive size in the Building 7, and it wasn't hit by a plane. So you got these three massive buildings all coming down by what the experts were saying was controlled demolition. Okay, so at that time, Richard Hall came out with this bizarre idea, which suddenly got picked up by all the press, although our critique was not being picked up by the press, that is to say the controlled demolition, that the, including, I think it was an article in the New Statesman, saying that the aircraft cannot have entered the buildings because they were made of aluminium, they would have bounced off the buildings, and therefore the aircraft were holograms. There was no aircraft hit the Twin Towers at all. So this, to me, immediately smacks of psychological operation in order to try and steer the public around the Western world away from starting to see the 9/11 attacks as an inside job, because obviously you need inside people to put explosives in a building to bring it down by controlled demolition. So that was my introduction to Richard Hall.
Okay, so let's wheel it back now to the Manchester Arena bombing, because if we go into all the conspiracies, we'll run out of time. So I understand that was your first kind of suspicion surrounding him. And, you know, he's embedded over, you could say, this side of the fence. So he looks like he's on our side. He looks like he's doing investigative journalism. Until you go and have a look at the investigative journalism, because when I started looking at him, I was on Telegram at the time. I can't get back into my own channel at the moment. I can't even blame anybody. I think it's just my phone number has changed and I can't actually get back in again. But anyway, I brought it up on Telegram and I got such a reaction. I mean, 4,000 people just dropped me overnight, practically, because they did not like what I was saying. I was literally pointing out, this is really questionable journalism. I wouldn't even call it journalism, and it's leading in the wrong direction. But they would not hear of it. They said, no, they were crisis actors and there was no bomb, because this guy, his journalism is so brilliant that he's, you know, directed us, and this is the right conclusion. And what I was shocked about by their reaction was just how brainwashed is the word, really and truly. It's a word nobody likes to hear. But they were so convinced, let's say, so convinced by the no bomb, no victims conclusion that they would not even look. They wouldn't even look at the evidence I was putting forward, saying that's actually misdirection. That's not real journalism. What do you make of that?
Well, the question is, we all need to ask, is this incompetence or is it a deliberate lying? And, of course, we like to give people the benefit of the doubt. That's part of our human nature. But when you see a so-called investigative journalist like Richard Hall constantly getting things wrong, this is about targeting the victims even more. So when it comes to Manchester, just a simple look at the film and footage available. I mean, I've done exactly the same sort of thing recently, in fact, with the 7/7 London bombings, looking at the original source material and matching up the government narrative to it. Hall's narrative doesn't match at all. The things he says are evidence are just not evidence, such as you pointed this out too, and I remember seeing this at the time and thinking this is rubbish, is there's somebody, a photo of somebody on their phone, and Hall says that this is evidence that there was no bomb and that the person is just having a casual chat. Well, of course, it's not evidence of that at all. And I think when it comes to these terror attacks, and particularly when people have been killed, injured, lost limbs, that your evidence is, you can't just make little speculative evidence so-called like this. You have got to have literally 150% certain evidence before you say anything about somebody that's been injured, murdered, killed or lost a limb being a part of a perpetrator of an attack. Because you have to think of the psychological effect that these people have already had through losing loved ones, through losing limbs. And the idea that you're now going to pile insult on injury by blaming them for their own loss. This is why I think we've seen such a reaction by, and quite right reaction in my view, by the victims' families and victims themselves from Manchester. When I looked at it at the time, the Manchester, because you have to think about the context of the Manchester Arena bombing. You've got it was just in the run-up a couple of weeks before, and there were a couple of other terror attacks too in London. The 2017 general election, where Jeremy Corbyn was actually looking like he could potentially become the Prime Minister. In fact, he did extremely well in that election. And in the run-up to that, a bit like the Joe Cox and the referendum, there was this terrorist campaign. Now, I mean, the idea that somebody might just target randomly just before an election. I look at that whole Manchester, Westminster, London Bridge attacks as part of the process to try and get people to vote against Corbyn. Because if you remember, just after the Manchester attack, Boris Johnson, the Conservative, was coming out with all this stuff about, oh, look, Corbyn is a terrorist. And there were loads of pictures in the mainstream press saying, showing pictures of Jeremy Corbyn with Palestinian freedom fighters, some of them, you know. But anyway, the point is, Corbyn, of course, is not a terrorist. He's a lifelong peace campaigner. Corbyn was doing a really good job. But this attack in Manchester, what it did is it spun the whole agenda back onto terrorism. Oh, look, Corbyn's a terrorist. The idea was, I think, to simply convince people that they should vote against the terrorist Jeremy Corbyn. But actually, when it comes to the attack itself, quite clearly people did die. The question is, was it Salman Abedi, the alleged bomber, that did it? Abedi was the son of Ramadan Abedi. Ramadan Abedi was very closely working with MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Service, over in Libya to undermine and attempted to kill Colonel Gaddafi. And this was revealed by David Shaler and Annie Machon, the former MI5 officers, back in the 1990s. And his son is running around. So apparently his son, although he was reported to the MI5 to anti-terror hotline several times, he was the one who supposedly did it. The only trouble was there was no actual evidence for I don't think there still is any evidence putting him actually in the Manchester Arena. But certainly for the first couple of years after that, up to 2019 or so in the inquiry, all we got from MI5, MI6 and the police was a picture of Abedi with a black background where you couldn't see where he was with a backpack. And that was supposed to be evidence that he was there. So I think the real agenda with Manchester was somebody else may have put a bag in the foyer. So it was most likely a false flag attack. So the bomb was planted by somebody who could have even been working with British intelligence or one of our allies, like the Israeli intelligence services, the Americans maybe. And then that was blamed on Abedi, who was most likely a patsy. So I think that was actually what was going on at the Manchester attack. And of course, what Richard Hall's agenda and narrative of, oh, there was no bomb, does is exactly what he was doing during the 9/11 attacks, which is as people start to figure out what was going on, it's worth mentioning Dawn Waddy at this point, and she was in the arena. She said there was someone fiddling with their bag, wasn't watching the concert, sitting next to her.
We sat down in our seats. To start from the beginning, we had somebody sat next to us and looked very suspicious. She was fidgeting all the time with a bag on the floor across her. She was by herself.
What was she doing?
She was looking in the direction of where the explosion actually happened all night and smirking to herself. I got suspicious myself, and my friend said to me, who was actually sat next to her, directly next to her, had said, I don't like this. She was fidgeting with her bag and the zips and on and off, hands in the pockets, and it puts you on edge.
What did you do about it?
I told security, who then informed a higher security. They were up and down the stairs where she was sat, discreetly watching her. I knew what they were doing. Nothing was actually done about it. And then later on, as the concert was going and Ariana actually came on the stage, she was getting more and more agitated. The bag was then on the floor, and I actually sat next to her, and I said, and I actually nudged her arm intentionally so I could actually speak to her. And I said, oh, sorry about that. Oh, are you by yourself? And she said, yes, and she spoke to me, but I didn't understand her.
So we don't know whether this lady had anything to do with it. But you were worried enough to talk to security.
Yes,
they listened to you, although you say that they didn't really do anything.
I don't think security did listen to me.
Then what happened?
Because then my daughter got very upset about things, Holly, and she went to security, and they basically told her, how would you like it if someone accused you of this? We'll look into it. And nothing was done about it.
And then, of course,
the concert went on. This lady was more agitated. 1 to 2 minutes before the concert finished, this lady disappeared. And then, of course, the explosion went off in the other end of the stadium.
And what can you remember of that? What did you
see? Oh, it was just a huge boom. I never saw no smoke, no flashes or anything. They were trying to blame the balloons, because there were some large helium balloons, but the boom was too big. It was too big. It couldn't have been a speaker, because the music had finished. Ariana, she'd gone off the stage. So then everyone started screaming and just charged to the nearest exit, up the stairs. It was a stampede. It was just absolutely horrendous. People were pushing me. I was just running. And fortunately, our hotel is just 5 minutes away, so we ran and got into the hotel. But it was just absolutely horrendous, and the security was awful. I'm sorry to say that the security did nothing about it, and there should have been more security. And we walked through the doors when we had our tickets, and they scanned your tickets, and we wasn't even checked. They never checked bags at all.
So none of the bags were checked, so you have to ask, what was security actually even doing? Why didn't they just go down the pub? No one is checking bags on the way in, and nobody is checking bags when people say this person is acting suspiciously. And then this woman left after the security people had refused to check this woman's bag at the end of the concert, just before the bomb explosion. The woman left a little bit early, and just a minute or so after she'd left the arena, the bomb went off. So I think that we're looking at a false flag attack. So in other words, a friendly so-called intelligence service planting the bomb, and it all being blamed on this Libyan Islamic fighting group guy, Salman Abedi. And that's the other important thing, is in that part of Manchester, there was this MI6 cell, which had been used to overthrow Gaddafi. And they were, a lot of these ex-Libyans who exiles, you might call them, that had been trying to destabilise Gaddafi for years, they were in that part of Manchester. So they were the so-called... But you see, what Hall has done by coming out with this nonsense, and actually really pernicious, poisonous nonsense about nobody being killed, again, is to steer the national narrative away. So the press is looking in the wrong direction. Everyone's saying, well, here's a lunatic conspiracy nut steering everybody away from what really happened, which was a bomb. But actually what gets lost in all of this is who actually put the bomb there. Was it the guy the government says or not? And Hall has done a pretty good job in getting everybody tied up and going down the rabbit hole saying there was no bomb at all. So the actual attack itself, this is why I find Hall so pernicious and really, I think, a very dangerous guy. He's paving the way for the next false flag attacks.
Yeah, so obviously Hall has been put there. He's not just a time waster. I mean, it's more than that. It's actually quite incredible that he's managed to convince so many people who won't hear. They won't hear of it when you say, have a look at this. Have a look at that. Before we proceed, let's just look at one of them. I've isolated clips from his output. I actually can't find it online now. I don't know if it's gone now, so I'm quite happy I did this. because it's worth analysing again. It's worth putting on the table. So let's just pop it up here.
He thinks that I'm an actor, we're both actors, that we weren't there on the night, that I've not got a spinal cord injury or that we got our injuries. I think he thinks that we're in a car crash or something like that.
I've never said that they do not have injuries. In my film, which covers the injuries, which you can find here, I state clearly that I have no evidence that they were in a car crash, and I did not make that claim. I made a hypothesis about a car accident.
Mr. Hibbert, we know that you've seen then the sequence of events that shows the time that you and Eve entered the arena, and your parking and VIP package meant that you avoided the crowds.
Correct.
And we see you entering the arena at 8:03. So, Mr. Hibbert, we're going to move forward now to, as you made your way out of the concert bowl and the route you took, we know that you found your way taking the route into the city room. And you have also been shown the image of you and Eve timed at 22:30:53. Where you're captured in the city room.
Yeah. These were his injuries here now.
Mm-hmm.
Shrapnel going straight through his left bicep, leaving a golf ball sized hole and a metal nut hitting his neck, severing his jugular vein and partially rupturing his carotid artery, causing severe blood loss.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and yet he lived still.
Hey, here we go, another bicep injury.
There was a lot of blood coming from my left arm and quite a lot of blood coming from my neck to the point where, you know, it was kind of gathering in a pool. I think I knew at that point that I was dying because I was starting to shiver. And then I remember a gentleman stood at my side and he was instructed to put a pad on my neck and... It just all goes white then, and then I kind of pass out.
Because as we've said, we think there are a number of genuine injuries, but I don't see any evidence that any of the real injuries occurred at the arena.
But when I was in the High Court last week with my friend had to grab my arm because I was shaking, because I had to listen to him for an hour and a half, you know, talk the drivel.
I did not speak for an hour and a half. I spoke for about 45 minutes. I will give details of that later.
One, he didn't think that we were related, so he didn't think that Eve was my daughter. I had to.
So what he was trying to gather, yeah, what he claimed was evidence.
But the worst part of it all is that I Kerry had to ring me one day and say, "Look, we need Eve's birth certificate." I was like, "What for? Like identification?" He went, "No, he's saying that you're not related." That was the worst moment for me. I had to send my birth certificate into the courts to prove that I was her father, and I'll never forgive him for that.
This is just legal protocol. You can ask for proof of any part of a legal claim being made against you. But this point about being father and daughter has been now agreed by both parties.
People don't see what happens behind closed doors, you know, the tears and the tantrums, the frustrations, and we've had to deal with that for 5 years, as well as living with a spinal cord injury and all the setbacks. I was in hospital 3 weeks ago for 5 days. You know, and I'm not, you know, I'm only probably 75% fit, you know, and there's all the stuff that comes with that. You know, Eve's currently unwell. People don't see that because you don't put that on social media.
In my years of investigation, I did not find any evidence to show that a real bomb was used. But I did find video and photographic evidence which shows beyond doubt that there was no bomb.
Everything that we've put up with for the 5 years happened, and it was harassment. You know, we have won solidly, you know, so, you know, I'm very proud, and I can't wait to get home and see Eve tomorrow because she's going to get a massive hug, but it has been tough.
So what do you think the reason behind that court case and the fact that it was so public? It was on the BBC, it was all over the mainstream media, and of course it made people who look at these things it made people who look at these things with a critical mind, it made them look really nasty.
Well, it's targeting us as independent freelance journalists. It's, you know, who critique the government account of these things. But more importantly, of course, it's a horrific harassment campaign against the victims and the families of lost loved ones. You know, this is a way of tying them up in knots when they could and should be wrestling with the legal process of a public inquiry and understanding, you know, who it is that's killed their loved ones, whether it's some guy, Salman Abedi in Manchester, or whether it's a geopolitical entity which has got a lot of power and staff like an intelligence service. So this has tied them up. This has tied them up completely. I honestly think that Richard Hall should be, I don't know, like just deported or something, because his role here has been so utterly disgusting and pernicious. Is everybody that's been sucked in? I mean, I don't know if people are sucked in. A lot of them, I think, are complicit, in fact, with him in the lie. And they don't, they just fancy going along with it because they like a good conspiracy. A lot of people I notice in the sort of conspiracy world just like the fact that it's a good story. You know, this is a good story, isn't it? And of course, it's true that, say, for example, at the Boston Marathon bombings, it's quite clear there were some crisis actors there, people who looks like the use of fake blood and things like that. But then you've got to be, you know, you can't just say that every terror attack is crisis actors. And he's got no proper evidence for this at all. So the effect has been most horrendous and horrific on the survivors who've been injured. Quite clearly, I don't know how bolts and a bolt bomb and shrapnel from it can be considered like a car injury. It's not the same thing at all. There's this thing about doubting whether this person is his daughter. I mean, all of this is almost what you're doing here is treating the victims of a horrific terror attack as the criminals themselves. He's completely facing everybody in the wrong direction, Aisling.
Yes, and I would say it's quite evil in its own way, because so he's convinced people who should really know better, because they call themselves conspiracy theorists, and if you are, you should be more critical than this and you should have higher standards. That's why I always flip it back to the audience. I'm like, come on, audience, we need better than this. You need to raise your standards. He's convinced you with really, really bad evidence and you should know better. So that course goes down like a lead balloon, but still it has to be said.
Well, you know what? That's because most of those people aren't thinking about the effect on the victims. They're just thinking about, hey, this is a good story and I can talk about this down the pub, this kind of thing.
To look at victims and think that they're just crisis actors without proper evidence. If they were crisis actors, maybe you might think, okay, well, this person deserves it. But they're so convinced without evidence that these people are crisis actors that they feel entitled to slag them off. And we saw Gemma O'Doherty, a so-called investigative journalist, who is an associate of Richard D. Hall there, slagging off Martin Hibbert, laughing at him, mocking at his rehabilitation efforts, and encouraging her audience to do so. And her audience are just as bad. So it's reflected back out onto the audience. They think it's okay. Conspiracy theorists get a bad rep. And it's absolutely shocking. But I have another one here. So we have Ian Davis, who's also...
Just before that, can I just say something about... Because during COVID, the Light magazine did publish some quite good articles. I mean, for example, about the efficacy of chloroquine and ivermectin, which is, you know, some studies say 85% of people, or it has an 85% extra recovery rate if people are given ivermectin. And, you know, it's pretty clear this stuff works, but the Light paper did publicize some of this stuff. But ever since then, it's become worse and worse. And I can remember I was asked to be a moderator on their Telegram channel, which I was doing on and off for about, well, I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time doing it, for about a year or so. As soon as the Richard D. Hall court case came up, and I started saying, well, hang on a minute, what evidence has this guy got? He doesn't seem to have it. And I pointed out a few things to do with, we need to have, if you're going to talk about Richard Hall, you need to also critique him, not just put out his stuff as if it is the truth, right? And you know what? I was immediately, by Darren Nesbitt's partner, immediately removed. I was told off, and you're not no longer allowed to be a moderator on here. So there clearly is, there's a whole sort of gang of people who are not actually doing journalism. What they're doing is psychological operations, and I would put the Light paper in amongst that lot too.
Oh, absolutely. Darren Nesbitt was straight on. Anytime I bring this up, he's in the comments. He's trying to shut it down. We see Gemma O'Doherty. She was editor of The Light, The Irish Light. Again, she's using the same psychological tactics to try and say, well, they're just actors. It's very, very telling. And that is why this story is really, really important, because this is the nerve. And if we identify the network, well, then we're going to save ourselves an awful lot of hassle when they try and hoodwink us again.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. It is a network.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are things going on behind the scenes where these people are chit-chatting with each other. And actually what you end up getting is an echo chamber of lies. Mm-hmm. So some of the stuff they say is correct, but a lot of it is not. I mean, if you go back to World War II, Victor Rothschild at MI5 developed this thing called the double cross, which was where the German agents were feeding the Nazis with mostly true information. Some of it was semi-bogus, like they blow up a part of a factory that wasn't being used here in the UK, and that would be sent across as a great victory to the Germans. But then at the crucial stages, they would be misdirecting people. And that's, I think, what's going on with people like Hall. This is literally exactly the same sort of technique as the double cross was being used against. And, of course, if you think about it, the British public are now being treated as if by the security services, as if we were the Nazis in World War II, so we're being played by them.
Well, it's the same kind of techniques, but I'm going to pull up another clip here. This is Ian Davis and David A. Hughes, and I think this is a very, very telling clip, because, again, Ian Davis is acknowledging, yes, there were people injured. So he's also part of the no bomb, no victims conclusion, false conclusion, I would say, along with David A. Hughes.
Well, so how did people get injured if there was no bomb? Yes,
exactly. But here we go. So let's watch him tie himself up in knots. This is quite revealing.
As we were talking about earlier, we don't know what happened to those victims. But I mean, if I was and one of the reasons that people are often criticised for questioning this kind of thing is the emotional impact, if they become aware of it, it could have on bereaved family members.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I've discussed in my book is that there's no reason to think that the family members aren't genuinely bereaved. I don't know what happened to their loved ones, and presumably they have been told what happened to their loved ones. So, you know, I think in a sense, trying to find out what happened to those 22 people is important in of itself, but it's also important for the bereaved family members, because what we may be suggesting is that they don't know. They can't be certain what happened to their loved ones. And personally, if I was in that position, I would want to know.
Have you had any bereaved families approach you?
No.
That seems odd in some ways, that if someone is digging on this issue, if I were a bereaved family member, I would want more information and would welcome the work that you're doing. Is there a possibility that the bereaved families were told to just be quiet or paid off, or what could have happened that none of the 22 families, nobody has reached out to?
Well, I mean, I think, again, you can only speculate about that. And, you know, I mean, and I've got no evidence upon which to kind of form any kind of speculation about that. You know, it's...
Does it seem strange, though? That seems odd to me.
Well, it depends, doesn't it? Because if people are convinced by... I mean, one of the analogies I would use is that we certainly know that a few of the family members were informed by the police that their loved ones had died in a bombing. If a police officer came to my door and informed me of that, you know, why would I question that necessarily? You know, why would I question that? And if the bodies are, you know, not in a fit state, again, we know that family members were told that their loved ones wasn't really suitable to view them.
So none of these families have ever had a proper postmortem or autopsy, or have been able to view the bodies.
No. Well, some did. Some said that they did. Some said that they did. I mean, one father in particular said that he remained with his daughter until the point of her death. So some families have said that. The majority haven't.
Right. So that's Ian Davis tying himself up in knots. So if there was no bomb, how did they get their injuries? He doesn't know. They got their injuries. The injuries are consistent with a bomb blast, but, you know, there was no bomb. So this is why it gets ludicrous. And this is why the audience should be held to account as well. It's like, why are the audience going along with this? At least this interviewer, at least she's asking probing questions. And she's more or less exposing them. She's more or less saying, well, this is daft. I mean, she's not going that far.
What Ian Davis seems to be hinting here is that their family members that they've lost were maybe kidnapped and killed by somebody else and not at a bombing. Yeah. I mean, this is starting to get really absurd. Mm. And of course, again, we're being misdirected. We're talking about, we're looking into questions which are legitimate questions behind the scenes, but they're certainly not legitimate to make public if you're questioning whether someone is who they say they are or whatever. But the real question here is that these families of all, I have direct and indirect contacts with the Manchester and the 7/7 London bombings survivors and victims' families. And their big beef is with the security services failing to answer any of their questions. So, for example, the alleged perpetrators in the London bombings, one of them, Haroon Aswat, has had £65,000 in legal aid. And yet the 7/7 families were refused any legal aid when it came to the inquest. And so imagine that, you know, you're faced with a situation where you can't ask that the coroner is refusing to allow you to ask any questions of the security services, who appear for the very first time ever just behind a screen. There's no actual face in the inquest. It's just a screen with a voice coming out from behind it. We've never had that before. And this is what is really annoying the actual survivors and the victims' families, is the fact that they're getting absolutely no answers to any of their questions. And that, yet there we are quibbling about some idea that maybe somebody is got an injury from somewhere else, or maybe the police were lying to them when they came and told them at the door. So this is part of the post-truth agenda. So we're not only got bad... we have really no proper investigative journalism going on in the mainstream press. It's also the alternative press is being corralled and co-opted here by fake investigative journalists who are asking the wrong questions and also blaming victims, not the perpetrators. They're not trying to find, it seems, the actual perpetrators at all, who are most likely invulnerable. The sort of perpetrators of these terror attacks from the Operation Gladio films. We know the NATO intelligence services spent most of the 1980s bombing their way around Europe, killing hundreds of innocent civilians and trying to blame those terrorist attacks on the Russians. And so this is nothing new, really. And they're not looking at that context, that background of these powerful geopolitical organizations that are totally unaccountable at all. And so there's a sort of multiple attack on the victims. So the victims are losing their loved ones. They're finding no actual redress through the legal and judicial system. And not only that, the fake alternative press is hammering them with a load of insulting, appalling questions, treating them as if they're the perpetrators. And the end result of all of this is that it's quite possible that new laws will be brought in to restrict freelance journalists, investigative journalists and alternative journalists. And the lawyers, for example, in the Manchester Arena case are telling those people, look, don't speak to anybody about it apart from if we say so. So they're being controlled now. Access to those individuals is being controlled by the lawyers, and this is all a result of individuals, particularly Richard Hall, but people like that. So they're being isolated in so many ways and attacked in so many ways, these victims' families and the survivors, that the idea is we don't want to hear what they've got to say. We don't want to hear any of their concerns, although the public, of course, do want to hear it. They're being driven, and this, what this does is, as I was just briefly mentioning before, is it makes the next terrorist attack, more likely, more easy for the authorities to control. That, I think, is the purpose of Richard Hall and the small group of people around him who are echoing everything he says uncritically.
Yeah, because they make they're maxing it out. They're maxing out the conspiracy theory thing to the limit and making it really, really nefarious and making the people who repeat it look stupid, untrustworthy and bad, you know, just nasty. So you can see where it's all going. But just as an aside, I thought this was quite interesting. In that same interview with Ian Davis and David A. Hughes, just take a look at this. Now, maybe I'm making something of it, and maybe this is how you do inverted commas these days. But just take a look at this.
Piece of camera phone evidence, which appeared on a BBC documentary.
I mean, do you do inverted commas like that these days? Is that a new thing?
Well, I do my inverted commas like that.
Yeah.
Okay, not maybe you can say it's like this. No. But look, I don't know about that. Yeah. David Hughes is a very interesting guy. I've interviewed him a couple of times for my weekly program in Bristol over the years. He produced some very good stuff about the Fourth Reich, which was looking at the sort of financial networks after the Second World War that have been set up using Nazi money. Certainly with David going down this support role for Richard Hall, I won't be having him on my programme anymore.
Well, he deserves to be called out over it. He deserves to be analysed. You know, he's begging for it, really. The fact that he is putting his weight behind this, and he's doing like 10-part series, you know, trying to prove there was no bomb and no victims. So,
but in a way, I'm sort of cutting off my own nose to spite my face, because some of these people I'd be quite happy to debate with. You know, if they want to have I've debated with David Aronovich about the 9/11 attacks, for example, and I think it's important these discussions and debates are had, and these people are called out for what they are, which I think is MI5 stooges. I'm not sure if it's MI5 they're working for. It could be a foreign intelligence service, but they're definitely not journalists. They're not looking at the truth, and they're not actually thinking about the consequences of the words they say, unless, of course, they're thinking about trying to make the next terrorist attack in Britain more likely and more easy for the authorities to spin.
Well, there's no way you could put out all that information the way they put it out, sidestepping the obvious questions, sidestepping the obvious evidence that's before them, redirecting people over in another direction. There's no way they can do that without knowing exactly what they're doing. You know, so it cannot be an innocent thing. It just simply cannot be. So no. Then you have to go, well, what is it? So if it's not innocent, what is it? I will say, for some of the people who repeat it, unknowingly, or who think, okay, Richard D. Hall is an incredible investigative journalist, and David A. Hughes, he's this intellect from Oxford, and Ian Davis, oh, he's the everyday man who sits in his van and he does this incredible investigative journalism. So they tap into the personas rather than test what they're putting out to see if it's true or not. I can forgive them to a certain extent just for being a little bit dozy and not actually using their own brains to test it and see, is that true? Is that actually proper evidence?
Well, look, the fact is, as journalists, we've got a big responsibility, you know, because most of the public have not got the time and effort or expertise to actually dig into all of this stuff. And they have to just kind of look at the TV, maybe, oh, gosh, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, my experience is that you often find in poorer areas of the city, council estates and things like that, that is where some of the best of the documentaries, like, for example, Loose Change on 9/11 and Ludicrous Diversion on the 7/7 London bombings, get watched and get circulated. And many of the people who live in the poorer areas are actually well aware that the establishment are carrying out these lies, and the media and the universities are all complicit with it. So there is a definite scepticism amongst poorer parts. I don't know what it's like in Ireland. Here in England, that they know that the establishment is lying all the time, but they will look at all of the press coverage. I would say one thing about the next false flag attack, wherever that happens, or terrorist attack generally, whatever it happens to be. And of course, all this idea of terrorism was cooked up by the Israelis and Benjamin Netanyahu, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s. Netanyahu even wrote a book all about, oh, how we can beat the terrorists, you know. But there he was in London on the 7/7 London bombings day. He got a warning from it in their embassy, but they didn't tell Scotland Yard or anybody else. And so no one else in London apparently got a warning of the 7/7 bombings. And the point is that this is a whole agenda of terrorism. They're now saying that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is part of the government, is a terrorist organization. So what are you going to say? Are you going to say that Putin, in British law, is a terrorist? And anybody that says that what he's saying is correct about British drones being used, for example, against Moscow, if you repeat that you become a terrorist. So there's a whole psychological warfare agenda behind, you know, what was it? Nelson Mandela said something like, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. And this is a word, and particularly with the proscription by Yvette Cooper of Palestine Action, saying that peaceful direct action to stop genocide is now, support for that is now a crime in Britain. You can see where this whole terrorist agenda is going. Everybody that starts to tell the truth at some point, as George Orwell might point out, is going to become a terrorist. So that's why Richard Hall's work is so pernicious in muddying all the waters around a proper investigation of terrorism and the causes here in the UK. I mean, I think he just needs to be called out. And although he's doing a tour at the moment of Britain trying to raise funds, this, of course, is another psyop. They're doubling down on the lies, and he's convincing himself or someone that he will, I'm sure, raise money like this. But it doesn't mean to say that he's telling the truth. I believe he's just deliberately out there lying in order to try and save his reputation, just as the same way as some of the mainstream press has been lying to save its reputation, like the BBC over the 9/11 attacks and the 7/7 bombings, particularly Jane Stanley. As people will remember, the BBC lied about that. She was on the TV talking about the collapse of Building 7 while it was still standing up behind her. So she's proving, isn't she, that the mainstream press is just reading a script. It's not doing journalism at all. It's reading a script in a movie, basically.
Yeah. And in order to bring back real journalism, we need a real audience to help as well. So you need a real audience that wants high standards, that won't put up with being hoodwinked. And we're getting there, say, with the mainstream, but with the alternative media, there's a bit of a way, because I think people have been lulled into a false sense of security with certain personas. And it really is up to them too. But Tony, I think we will wrap it up there because we've covered quite a lot.
Can say one more thing, and that is about, I think it's a really good idea that serious journalists get together and point out key disinformationists like Richard Hall and some of those around him, but particularly Hall, who's quite clearly at the centre of this one. But also be aware of what to do if there is another false flag attack, because one of the things we've learned from 9/11 and 7/7 is record everything as soon as anything happens. And this is the way these things are done nowadays. Many people right now are saying that there could be a false flag on Britain or America of some kind, or an assassination of Trump, in order to restart the war against Iran. That would probably be carried out by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. So that's but mainly the Israelis and their supporters in Britain and America. And if and when that something like that does happen, God forbid, it's really important to record everything, to just make sure that whatever's on the TV, whatever channel you're on, record, record, record. Because quite often, little bits and pieces come out in the initial coverage, which will... In the weeks and months ahead, will completely pull apart the government narrative. So that's an important thing to remember. And just think about 7/7, for example. On the afternoon of the 7/7 bombings, the ex-head of the Mossad published in the Jerusalem Post an article saying that the bombs were synchronized at the same time on the London Underground, and also... what he was doing was saying that it was that the attack went very much to plan. Well, how does he know it went to plan? What's he talking about? How did he know? Because London police even didn't know that all the bombs had happened at the same time on the afternoon of 7/7. And so this was a very much a revealing article showing that the Israelis had far, far more knowledge of what was going on in London than anyone in London had. And we have to ask the question of how is that? What did they have their Mossad officers on the trains? How did they know all these things? And that article was then a couple of days later, or maybe a week later or so, pulled off the Jerusalem Post website because it was evidence that the Israelis had a massive foreknowledge of what had actually been going on the 7/7 bombings. And that's the sort of thing we need to grab, capture, keep a hold of, and waggle in the faces of the security services, government, and the press in the weeks and years after any attack that does happen.
And I think it's very important as well to appeal to the victims, because we know when the victims do any interviews, they're torn apart by, say, you have Richard D. Hall with that behavioral analysis, apparently Genevieve, what was her name, Lewis. So they're ripping them to shreds when they do any interviews. And we can see what the agenda behind that is to get the victims to shut up. Go away. Don't do any interviews. Stay silent and stay in the shadows. So they don't want the victims speaking out. They don't want the victims having a voice. They don't want. And even I was noticing with Martin Hibbert, with that court case with Richard D. Hall, his grabs, his sound bites were really short and kind of disjointed as well. So we weren't really getting, you know, what he was going through. I found that one where he was saying how hard it was. That was buried on the internet somewhere on some early morning TV show. I managed to get, I think it was a radio show actually. So it was totally buried. Only like I've pulled it out and put it into the light to say, listen to him, listen to this victim and what he's going through. But you see, because we have this audience who think they're all crisis actors who are convinced by it, we need them to hang back a minute and we need to allow the victims to speak. But also the victims have to understand that this is also part of the operation. It's really, really nasty, but we must hear their voices. We must hear their side.
I think they do. I think the victims' families and the survivors do understand that there's quite an operation again. I mean, what's the Richard Hall, the effect of Richard Hall has been this pernicious. What's now happening is the lawyers are becoming the gatekeepers. So they're having to go to the lawyers and say, look, can you just, you know, the lawyers are telling them, don't speak to anyone without our say so. And so, you know, maybe a lawyer right now, today, acting for somebody might be honest and decent. Lawyers in the future may not be so honest and decent. And, for example, they will do their best to keep victims away from people like you and I. So this is becoming a control. The idea is to completely control. This is the security service's aim, to completely control the narrative after an attack and make sure that there's a specific version that is not questioned. Now, this is not democracy, is it? This is not justice. And I think I know that many of the families directly involved in these terrorist attacks in the UK know this too, that their questions are simply not being answered, and I think what we really need is a proper public inquiry into 7/7 and Manchester, with the security services sitting there in the dock explaining why they did nothing to stop these attacks, even though they were warned multiple times about these individuals on both of those attacks.
Listen, the more we talk about it, the more we stick it up on the table and analyse it and have these discussions. And I would say, yeah, keep the channels open with those lads. Bring them back, you know, talk to them still. Because, yes, they do put out a lot of good stuff, but, of course they do. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Tony. I hope we get an opportunity to do this again and to go back over some clips and analyse. And it's really, really interesting getting your insights. So thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Okay, I'll just say my weekly programme is at thisweek.org.uk. It starts at 5 p.m. UK time on the live stream. And you can find various links from stories we do week to week. And, you know, we've been following quite a lot of this over the last few weeks because we haven't even mentioned COINTELPRO, Fred Hampton, and the way that the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s and 70s was destabilized by the FBI, which is America's MI5. This seems to be the idea that is to perpetrate the myth of the democracy by, as soon as there's a powerful civil rights movement starts to do things, then the government just by dirty tricks shuts it down. And we saw that, of course, with the SpyCops scandal, you know, with the environmental campaigners who hadn't even broken the law, having their lives hacked by the Metropolitan Police. And, you know, they're getting into bed with these people and even having kids with them, even though they've not even broken the law. So that's the extent the authorities in the UK, it seems, will go to in order to shut down the cause of justice in Britain.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's very dark out there, but there's a few shining lights. You're one of them. So thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.